Okay, let's continue. So we're picking up again, Perek Aleph, Mishnah Yud Zayin. So let's again just reorient ourselves a little bit. We are talking about Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. So let's just review a little bit of history. When is Rabbi Shimon Gamliel living? Times of the Churban Bayis Shni. We're actually going to get into that a little bit more Mir Tashem today. We began to see the incredible breakdown of everything around Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Breakdown of greater society. The Kahuna Gedola is yes. I don't have. I think they were here last week. Last class, no. No, I don't see them. I'm sorry. I'll get you one of your next class. Okay, so we saw the breakdown of the Kohanim Gedola. We saw ultimately, again, the exploitation of the Netzivim, the procurators, their own procurators were like the governors over the different areas in Eretz Yisrael. We spent a little bit of time focusing on, now despite all of this incredible, we'll call it, internal and external trauma, yet in the midst of all this, you see Rabbi Shimon Gamliel was the life of the party at the Simchas Beis HaShoeva. I remember again, what was he doing at the Simchas Beis HaShoeva? What was he doing?
Fire.
Juggling. Come on, you got to give him not just juggling fire, he was juggling 7 to 8 torches, right? He was doing his kida thing. I don't know what the good English word for that is. The bending up and down without moving his knees. So again, obviously we see someone who in the midst of incredible difficulties still is trying to maintain a certain level almost of simcha for the general populace. We also focused a little bit on we saw in number 7, the piece in the Sefer Chachamim, which spoke about Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's interesting takana. What was his takana regarding the women who gave birth? What was the takana? Excellent, good. Remember again, the halacha d'oraisa is that a woman brings a bird offering for every birth. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel instituted that ultimately, again, she could bring one bird offering for multiple births. What was the motivation of this particular takana? Good. So first of all, to lower the prices. Why does he want to lower the prices? So people are bringing karbanos. Remember again, this was about engagement. And this is going to become something exceptionally important regarding Rav Shimon Gamliel, which is the notion of creating engagement within Klal Yisrael. Klal Yisrael is becoming so incredibly splintered, right? We are splintering off into such dramatically different types of groups that Rav Shimon Gamliel sees that his job as the leader is to be the koach ha-ma'achid, to bring everyone together. Which, of course, is no simple feat. You know, I think I mentioned this in the past. If you look throughout Tanakh, pretty much up until Shlomo HaMelech, all of our great people started out in what profession? Shepherding. Why? Why shepherding? The lawyers, accountants. So it could be, number one, could be an issue of almost like contemplation. David HaMelech speaks about this in Tehillim, this idea that as the shepherd, you have time out in the pasture, you have time with the flock, there's time for you to contemplate, to introspect. Good, why else?
Hashem tests you out with
the small thing. The small thing before, so what's the test?
Do you take care of the sheep?
How do you take care of the sheep? So if anyone knows from their extensive experience with shepherding, what happens when you have a flock of sheep together? Take a wild guess. Good. The sheep do not follow directions, right? They go in all different directions. And some want to go slower, some want to go faster. This one wants to travel, this one wants to drink. And what's the job of the shepherd? Keep everyone together. So this is an incredible training ground for what it means to be a Maneg Yisrael. Within Klal Yisrael, we have never been and will never be a people of one opinion, or for that matter, one Hashkafas HaChaim, or one approach to our Kodesh Baruch Hu, all the Torah. There are multiple different streams within the Jewish people. The job of the leader is at the end of the day to try to keep the flock together. How do you balance the needs of everyone and still keep them together? So this is really like incredible. If you think about this, if you're Rav Shimon Gamliel, and on one hand, you see again, there's a tension with the Bar Yonim and the Rabbanim. There is the tension with the Romans. Klal Yisrael is becoming splintered. And what does he do? He's trying to figure out small ways, and we'll see not such small ways, to keep the Klal together. I mean, the truth is, it's not just the job of the Manig, it's the job of every Jew to figure out what we can do to promote a heightened degree of communal achdus, but it's most pronounced, ultimately, again, with the Manhig Yisrael. He is the one, ultimately, who has, he is the shepherd. He is the shepherd. He has to set the tempo. So I always find like dramatic. You know, you ever hear the expression arranging deck chairs on the Titanic? Ever that expression? So you're familiar with the Titanic, right? So the expression arranging deck chairs on the Titanic is like when the ship is going down and you're busy moving furniture on the deck of the ship, which of course is a meaning. So sometimes in life, people don't realize that the ship is going down and they're just like busy taking care of stuff that's nonsensical. So on one hand, you look at Rav Shimon Gamliel and you say literally, Jewish society is imploding. And you're bothering with the burnt offerings. And the truth is, he's absolutely right, because what is he doing? And we're going to see, there are many things that are occurring that are beyond Rav Shimon Gamliel's control. So what does he choose to do? He chooses to exercise his control over those things that he can influence. I could enfranchise the women who would be otherwise unenfranchised. I can make sure that people don't feel priced out or excluded from the Beis HaMikdash. Those are things that I could control. That's where he actively exercises his power as the shepherd. I'll show you something very interesting. Take a look at number 10. So this is from the Perish Man. So we've quoted from this Perish before. This was written by the Rebbe of Stefan Esht. Yes. No, we're going to go back. I'm just going a little bit out of order. Thank you. So take a look at number 10, because I just want to give you one more piece of history. Then we'll go back to 8 and 9. So the Rebbe of Stefan Esht writes as follows. Now again, remember, we've studied his commentary before. This is, remember, we saw his discussion about Aristotle and the soul and Plato. Stefan Esht Rebbe was a Hasidish Rebbe. He was a son of the Rabbi Yisrael of Rizhin, the Rizhiner. I do not know where he got his secular education from. I have no idea. But it's clear when you read his commentaries and his introductions here, he was very, very, very knowledgeable. Whether he was self-taught, I don't know. So look what he writes over here. So he quotes from the Mishnah. Shimon, who ben Rabbi Gamliel Hazakim. So the Shimon, first of all, that we're mentioning over here, is the son of Rabbi Gamliel Hazakim. Who Rabbi Shimon Gamliel? Hanerag bizman achorba. Now, there's a piece of the Rabbi Shimon Gamliel story that I did not allude to yet. I was kind of trying to save it for the end. But since the Rebbe mentions it now, Rav Shimon Gamliel is one of the Asara Harugei Malchus. He is one of the 10 martyrs who was murdered by the Romans during the times. Remember again, we're going to discuss that at the end of our section here. Kimo Yudches Shana Haya Nasi B'Yisrael. He was the Nasi, Rav Shimon Gamliel was Nasi for about 18 years. Hu Haya Ish Malei Das V'Rov Chachma V'Seichel Charif. He was a man who was filled with knowledge, spirit, wisdom, and sharp intellect. And he was the Jewish leader. He was the Nasi during the times of really Roman invasion. Now here's another very important historical fact that you're going to see. When Rabbi Shimon Gamliel was the Nasi during the time of the last great rebellion by the Romans. When was the last great rebellion by the Romans? Bar Kokhba. This is incredibly important. Bar Kokhba rebellion takes place when? Approximately 60 years after the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. Now, when we think about the Bar Kokhba rebellion, which personality do we often associate that rebellion with?
Rabbi Akiva.
So we'll discuss. Rabbi Akiva ultimately, again, was probably the chief or the most vocal rabbinic backer of Bar Kokhba. That's because what did Rabbi Akiva think about Bar Kokhba? That he could have been the Mashiach, right? He called him Bar Koziva, right? The son of the stars. He thought he had the capacity to be the Mashiach. But the point of it is, we're going to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel was exceptionally supportive and vocal about the rebellion. Rabbi Akiva is considered to be the greatest rabbinic backer of Bar Kokhba, but it's important, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel was the Nasi at that time. The rebellion would have never gone forward had the Nasi not backed it. So Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is the backer of the rebellion. He is the Nasi behind the rebellion. Velu Nasta Itzasa. Now, this is going to be wild, because you're going to begin to see some of the historical intrigue, which is incredible. I'm using this now, this piece, kind of just to set the table a little bit, and we're going to go back and analyze different pieces. But listen to these words. Velu Nasta Atzasa Lahorid Yosifun Ben Gurion, Milihio Sartzava Achel Galion. Listen to this. Who was leading the Jewish forces on the northern front during the times, during the rebellion against the Roman? A man by the name of Yosifun ben Gurion. Who is Yosifun ben Gurion? Josephus. the well-known chronicler of history. Josephus began as a devout Jew, actually in charge of the northern forces of the Jewish people. As we're going to see, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel has significant reservations about the allegiance of Josephus, and argued that Josephus be removed from his post. He should not be allowed to command the army. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's warnings were ignored. As a result, ultimately, again, Josephus does defect over to the Romans, and the Jews begin to lose the battle, the war against the Romans on the northern front. The Shtefanesh Rebbe just points out that had the Jewish people listened to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, as hayatikva liskar balaromim, there would have been meaning the weak flank of the Jewish army was in the northern front in the Galil. Had the Jews listened to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's concerns, ultimately Josephus would have been removed, and had Josephus been removed, it could be that they would have won against the Romans. Listen to this. Who knows? Maybe we would have had a victory like during the days of the Chanukah, during the days of Hanukkah. So by the way, what's incredible over here? What you begin to see like a theme in these kind of stories. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, what's the theme? I'm sorry? Things could have been different. See, it's amazing. Almost every single one of these dramatic stories has an ending like this, where it went in one direction, but it could have so easily gone in a different direction. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai could have asked Vespasian, please call off your armies, go home, and spare Yerushalayim this time. Would Vespasian have listened? Maybe, maybe not. He chose to take a more conservative approach, but maybe he could have saved Yerushalayim, the Beis HaMikdash, for some additional number of years. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel understood this guy Josephus, Josephus, there's just something about him that I just don't trust his loyalties. That was the weak flank of the Jewish army, that's where the Romans overtook us. Had he been replaced as general, then ultimately again, maybe the armies would have repelled the Romans just like we did with the Syrian Greeks during the Hanukkah story. It's an incredible, incredible thing. It's symptomatic of what? Well, why does this same type of narrative keep repeating itself? What? No nevuah. It's symptomatic of living in a world without nevuah. You see, where there's nevuah, where there's the Navi, so there's clear direction. Everything is scripted. You know what you have to do when something goes wrong. You know what you have to do in order to fix it. In the absence of nevuah, you just have to try your best. In the absence of nevuah, you kind of sometimes make an educated guess as to what the best approach is forward. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. Yes? So apparently not when it comes to the army. Remember again, a Nasi is not a Melech. A Nasi is not a Melech. There's a difference here. So a Nasi is the head, but apparently he didn't necessarily control the army in its entirety. Remember again, this might also not be the norm. You know, this is such a complicated situation over here. But working backwards, apparently the Nasi did not control the army. Or maybe, it could be, maybe Rabbi Shimon Gamliel wasn't forceful enough in his words. Maybe he raised the concern, but he didn't push it. I don't know. Because again, I'll tell you what's interesting about this is, I never heard this before I saw the Shtefanesh Rebbe's piece. And if you notice again, he's not sourcing it. He sources some of the stuff, but I don't know where he's getting some of these. That is, it could be, maybe it's in Josephus, maybe Josephus writes about it. I don't know. Gamhu asa takanas tovos. So now the Rebbe goes on to say that also Rabbi Shimon Gamliel also made takanas. He made enactments. What were some of his enactments? And here we go. Pam achos amdu akinu yisham. So here he speaks about the bird offerings. Skip down a little bit. V'chein hora, four lines up from the bottom, ends of the line. V'chein hora. So the first major takana that he makes is with the bird offerings that we studied already. This is actually amazing. V'chein hora shein lahachzik es hatzdukim kegoyim. What does that mean? V'chein hora shein lahachzik es hatzdukim kegoyim. How would you translate that phrase? First of all, who are the tzdukim? Good. They only believe in the Torah Shebichsav, not in the Torah Shebaal Peh, which of course we understand yields an incredible level of complications and essentially called their entire status into question. There was a raging dispute about how do you treat a tzduki. Is a tzduki a full-fledged Jew, or is a tzduki ultimately, again, considered to be like a non-Jew, like a Gentile? This machlokes went on for a while. There's a whole discussion about the tzdukim. Do they observe mitzvahs, not observe mitzvahs? For example, again, there's a discussion about the idea that whatever tzdukim keep, they keep more meticulously and religiously than even a regular Jew. But that which they don't keep, they totally discard. So what's the status of a tzduki? So apparently Rabbi Shimon came along, and what did he say? Shein lahachzik es hatzdukim kigoyim, elehein ki Yisraelim gimurim. What does that mean? Right? Tzduki is a full-fledged Jew. Now again, interestingly enough, I want to point out to you something amazing. These are the two enactments of Rav Shimon Gamliel. In fact, if you look at the next line, halachos lo niskeru mishmo. Ultimately, again, we don't really have halachos stated in the name of Rav Shimon. Remember again, warmly, when you see Rav Shimon Gamliel stated in the Gemara, that's the grandson of this Rav Shimon Gamliel, not this Rav Shimon Gamliel. So we don't really have a lot of halachos. So amazing enough, it appears that we have two halachos, though we'll see a third in just a moment, which is more of a principle than a halacha. Two halachos. Halacha number one was regarding the bird pairs of the woman who gave birth, and halacha number two is that stukim are not treated like goyim, but rather, again, they're treated like full-fledged Jews. What's the common denominator between these two enactments? Trying to create an atmosphere of inclusivity. Trying to put the disparate pieces together. Now again, I want to point out to you, see, this is a very important idea. We all believe in Achdus, right? Everyone believes in Achdus. But Achdus, of course, must occur within the framework of Halacha. Everything we do occurs. So for example, if I say, you know what? I have a great way to bring Am Yisrael together. I'm going to make Shabbos just Friday night. Just Friday night. We're going to shorten Shabbos. Could anyone get up and do that? Of course not, right? So meaning, you could do a lot of things for Achdus, but you could do them, you have to do them within an established framework. You can't go ahead. So obviously, when Rav Shimon Gamliel is doing these things, he's doing them within a halachic framework. So even though we're just kind of saying, yeah, tzdukim are like Jews. Okay, what does that mean? He decided, like, obviously, no, there's a halachic process to that. Similarly, there's a halachic process to declare that a woman could bring one bird offering for multiple births. But it's interesting that the two halachos that we have from him are focused on this need to kind of solidify the achdus of Klal Yisrael. How do we bring the Klal together? What do we do in order to everything, literally again, society, Yerushalayim, Eretz Yisrael, Am Yisrael, everything is imploding all around us. How do we keep the ship from sinking? And the answer of Shimon Gamliel felt is achdus. We have to figure out a way to bring in those people on the periphery so as to bolster the ranks of Klal Yisrael. So the women who were in the first halacha, who were not, it's not focusing on them because they're women. It was focusing on them, why? Because they were what? Because they were poor. Right? This was an issue of poverty. The poor are most often marginalized. So therefore, again, Rav Shimon Gamliel is coming along and saying, no, let's bring you in. Tzdukim are considered like Yisraelim. Obviously, you need the halachic backing and framework to be able to do this, but this is his focus. He adds on one more interesting thing. Klal Gadol Omer Rav Shimon Gamliel. Rav Shimon Gamliel came along and he said something else, which is incredible. She'ein ligzart al tzibor gzeros, ma she'ein rov hatzibor yecholim la'amod bahen. What does that mean? En gozin gzera al hatzibor ela im ken yachol rov hatzibor la'amod bahen. What does that mean? Excellent. You cannot go ahead and make a gzera on the tzibor unless the majority of the tzibor has the ability to keep it. This is an incredible idea. So which means the rabbis might have a great idea for halacha. This would be great if we can do it. If the majority of the population are not going to do it because it imposes a hardship, you cannot legislate it. By the way, what's the paradigmatic example of this? You must have learned this in a class at some point in time, either in school. So yes? Oh, so very good. I was not thinking about that one, but good. Right? Women wearing jewelry on Shabbos, good. That even though, again, one can make the technical argument that perhaps you shouldn't wear jewelry on Shabbos in a place where there's no Eruv, because it might break and you may carry it, but because it would compromise the basic, what's the word? Dignity or don't know what the right word is. You could help me out with this, no? Mm-hmm. Right, whatever the right, it would compromise her basic apparel selection. So therefore, we do it good. What else? Chalav Yisrael, though, Chalav Yisrael is an interesting one. So hold Chalav Yisrael for just a moment, right? There's actually that same family. There is close pas palter, right? Pas palter means bread baked by a Gentile baker. Let me give you 30 seconds on this, only because you brought up bread already before. So I'm gonna piggyback on that for just a moment. So listen to this. So the Gemara Maseches Avodah Zarah says as follows: the halacha is Chazal instituted. If your neighbor bakes bread, you know your neighbor likes you a lot. They bake you a nice loaf of bread. Ingredients are all kosher. Are you allowed to eat it?
No.
Why not? Right. Why not? Socialization. There's a whole bunch of gezeiros made by Chazal so as to avoid excessive socialization with non-Jewish neighbors. It's a fear of intermarriage. It's a fear of intermarriage. So because of that, there's something called pasakum. Pasakum is obviously if my neighbor bakes with non-kosher ingredients, nothing to talk about. But let's say again, my neighbor went ahead and cooked with all the ingredients. He even got flour that's yashin. Mamish, that's what a righteous Gentile he is. Everything is perfect. It's fantastic. I can't eat it because it was baked by an individual Gentile. A fear that if I go ahead and I break bread with a non-Jewish person, that will go ahead and could potentially lead to socialism. Again, understand, Chazal, the threat of intermarriage is not a new thing. It's always existed. So Chazal put up Gidarim. Now again, I want to be clear. This does not mean that we don't interact with the nations of the world. Of course we do. Meaning it's our mandate to be an Arla Goyim, a light unto the nations. So we have to engage. There's a difference between engagement and socialization. Those are two different things. Chazal were very wary of socialization. That's where the boundaries come down, the barriers come down, and all kinds of things could occur. Therefore, I cannot eat the bread baked by my Gentile neighbor. What about bread baked? So again, gzera mishum chasnus. And again, so to be clear, why is there concern of, I'm going to eat a slice of bread from my neighbor, and now suddenly my daughter's going to marry his son? Well, it sounds like a far, what's the pshat? There's a closeness. When someone invites you over for a meal, and someone bakes something for you, right? If somebody ever shows up with a baked good for you, you feel close to that person. They do something for you. So my neighbor goes ahead and bakes a loaf of bread for me, invites me over to have bread. There's a closeness that's engendered. It doesn't mean I take a bite out of the bread and suddenly again our children are engaged to get married. But what it means is it creates a bond. Good. What about bread baked by a Gentile baker? Right? Joe the Gentile has a bakery. Joe the Gentile's bakery. Right? He bakes bread. Can I purchase bread from him? So me'ikir adin, it would seem to be that I could. Assuming ingredient-wise it's kosher and things like that. Because why? Since the baker is mass-producing it, therefore what? There's no concern. There's no concern of chasnos. No one walks into the bakery. Oh, thank you so much for making this challah for me. I cannot believe you took the time to make this. Right, try it when you go into the bakery, and you're going to get some very strange looks because you're like, "Can you just pay for it and please move along?" Right? They didn't make anything for you. Pay and get out. Right? So there's no chasnos in a bakery. So that's why. So, but Chazal, however, wanted to go ahead and really make sure that I wouldn't end up eating the bread of my Gentile neighbor. So as such, they decreed on pas palter, right? Pas palter is a baker. So they said, not only can you not eat the bread of your Gentile neighbor, you also can't eat the bread of a Gentile baker. What happened? There were many communities that did not have Jewish bakers. So where did the Jewish community get their bread from? They got it from the Gentile baker. Right, the baker, when they make sure the baker used, kosher ingredients, maybe they'd have a mashgiach there or something, whatever, and that's how they bought their bread. By the way, this practice went on until like the proliferation of kashrus as we have it today. We have Baruch Hashem, very different standards of kashrus, but even not so long ago, this is what happened. If the bakery had kosher ingredients, you would go out and you would buy bread. You would buy bread. So what happened? Chazal realized that it was a gzira she'in hatzibor yachal la'amabo. If a lot of people are living in locales where all there is a non-Jewish baker, you can't legislate that they can't buy bread from that baker. If you do that, then effectively what? They won't have bread. Are they going to starve to death? No, but you can't do something that is a hardship upon some segment of the population. A gzera that imposes an undue hardship upon a significant majority of the population, Chazal not allowed to make it. So interestingly enough, what happened over here is they made the gzera paspalter, and then what? And then they removed it. Which is why today, if you go ahead and you buy bread, so people are still makbid. A lot of people are still makbid on Pas Yisrael. So again, if you're makbid on Pas Yisrael, if you go into the supermarket and you go ahead and you find a loaf of bread with a hashkacha, what is that? So more often than not, it's Pas Palter. 100% legitimately kosher, but there are people who are still makbid only on Pas Yisrael, which means they're not going to take... Now, again, I will point out, not a kashrus discussion, there are some commercial brands that also satisfy the criteria of Pas Yisrael. But again, but most times when you're buying a loaf of bread, you're buying Pas Palter, and that is 100% halachically okay. Chalav Yisrael is a little bit different. Again, not a halachish here. Chalav Yisrael is different. Chalav Yisrael is still on the books. Right, there's halacha of Chalav Yisrael. The only reason today why some people are not makbid on Chalav Yisrael is because of a tshuva by Rav Moshe, where Rav Moshe ultimately says that in America, and again, lav davka that this applies in other places, but in America, because we have the dairy industry is highly regulated, you cannot go ahead and market anything other than cow's milk as milk. Remember, the issue of Chalav Yisrael is you need a Jew to oversee the milking process out of concern that a Gentile might include other forms of milk. That's where Chalav Yisrael comes from. In a regulated dairy situation like we have here in America, so Rav Moshe said, now even Rav Moshe did not say you shouldn't use Chalav Yisrael. He just said again, there's what to be said if a person doesn't use Chalav Yisrael here in America. You do have to be very careful when traveling outside of America, because the truth is, again, other countries don't say have the same type of regulation when it comes to dairy. Okay, in any event, back to this. So now, Rav Shimon Gamliel was the one who said that you can't be gozer gzera, shena tzibor yachol la'amabah. So this is actually incredible. So why do you think it's Rav Shimon Gamliel who makes this idea? You cannot legislate a law that the majority of the population will have difficulty with. So again, why is it interesting that it's Rav Shimon Gamliel who's making this legislation? Why? What's the theme? Same idea. Meaning all of this is about tightening the bonds of class. Our job, now says Rav Shimon Gamliel, is to bring Jews in, is to bring Jews closer, is not to chas v'shalom create stress in their religious lives, but rather to find a way to bring them closer to one another and ultimately closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. An incredible, incredible idea. So essentially what we have are three halachos by Rav Shimon Gamliel. Number one, the halachos concerning the bird offerings. Number two, the halachos concerning ultimately the... The tzedukim, thank you. And number three, gzera shena tzibo yachol la'amabah. These are the three basic rulings, ultimately, again, Rav Shimon. And that's it. That's pretty much what we have from him. Yes. So you can't count them as a minyan. You wouldn't count them as the mezuman. If they were to cook, that food would be considered bishul akum, not bishul yisrael. Maybe you couldn't rely on their shechita. Things like that. Anything. I'm sorry? Correct. Of course not marry them. Correct.
But are they still
Jewish? So obviously, remember again, this gets into a more philosophical question, which is HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the Torah. And remember again, like the Bas Kol said, Lo Bashamayim Hi. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I gave it to you. I gave you the framework. Now you have to figure it out. So if Chazal legislate that the tzedukim are not kigoyim, then yes, that amazingly enough becomes the de facto Ratzon Hashem as well. As incredible as that sounds, that Chazal have the ability to determine what becomes the de facto Ratzon Hashem. So these are the enactments of Rav Shimon Gamliel. So again, I'm just pointing out, you see, even though they're few, you see a profound thread that goes through all of them. This idea, Klal Yisrael is in a traumatic state. Things are incredibly and overwhelmingly difficult. We need to figure out a way to create cohesion, togetherness, and achdus, while of course still maintaining fidelity and allegiance to Halacha. Let me show you, yes.
Sorry, how did they ever make that gezeira pas palter though? Before this?
Yes, so what happened was, is they made, yes, it was before this. It was before this, then they took it away.
Okay.
Yeah. And it could be also, I have to look chronologically. It might be interesting to see that Meir Rav Shem Gamliel said this as a result of that. I don't know. I have to look back at that Gemara by Avodah Zarah to see the chronology. It could also be, by the way, the simpler answer is that sometimes Chazal thought that Tzibur could handle it. Meaning, it could also be that Chazal thought that once they made this Gzera, Jews would open up their own bakeries. Apparently, they didn't. So it could also be they thought it was a Gzera Shat Tzibur Yachol La'amod Bo, but they were incorrect. They were incorrect. Okay, so let me show you two other pieces. Kind of now, I want to segue back. Now I've given you a little bit of the historical background. I've given you everything except Rav Shem Gamliel's death, which we're going to deal with a little bit separately. Let me show you. Take a look at number 8. So remember again, let's go back for a moment and focus on Rav Shem Gamliel's statement in the Mishnah. So what did Rav Shem Gamliel say? Remember going back to number 1. He says, "Kol yomai gadalti b'nei chachamim," which means what? Means what? What does it mean, I grew up amongst great people? Why did he grow up amongst great people? Because his father was the Nasi, right? Remember again, he's the son of Rabbi Gamliel. So obviously in his home is the gathering place for all of the rabbinic elite, for all the rabbinic leaders. So all of my days I grew up amongst great people. V'lamatzasi l'guftov el ashtika. I found nothing better for the body than silence. It is not the theory or the learning that is the ikar. Rather, again, it is the action. And again, whoever talks excessively brings sin. So let's analyze. Take a look at the Bar Tanura, number 8. So what's interesting is as follows. So what bothers you about Rav Shem Gamliel's statement? What's bothersome about that? I'm sorry? First of all, why the guf? Excellent. Really, nothing better for the body. Good. What else? We're going to get to that. What else?
He wasn't silent.
I'm sorry?
He wasn't silent.
Good. What else?
Not mitzvahs.
Good. Meaning, what a strange thing to say. That the best thing in life is passivity. Remember again, silence is passivity. If I'm silent, I'm not doing something. The best thing you could do for your body, whatever that means, the body piece, which you're going to get to, but the best thing you could do for yourself is to be silent? Really? Like, we're such an active, dynamic religion. We believe in accomplishing, we believe in doing it, and yet here Rav Shem Gamliel is telling me, no, you know what, the truth is, the best thing you could really do is to be silent. So what do you think? What's a possible answer? So it could, yes?
It's not necessarily, you always have to be quiet, just measuring.
Good. So it could be, maybe it's a non-absolute statement. Take a look at number 8. Says the Bar Tanura. V'teidilacha. Shashtika tova. So this is a profound statement. Bar Tanura says, no, silence is good. Silence is a good thing. Shafilu ha-medrash v'hadrash v'adibar b'torah. She'in lecha mida tova himeno. Ein ikar kibul schar ela b'shvil ha-maisa. V'hadorish ve'in l'makayim. Noach lo im hayashosek velo hayadorish. So here, the Bar Tanura says something that is actually quite amazing and something that we're going to see is like even a little bit controversial. What does he say? Shtika is good. There's no question. Why? He says, at the end of the day, learning and talking in Torah is very good, but learning and talking in Torah an ends?
No.
So by the way, so besides what the Bar Tanura says, what do you think? Is learning Torah an ends? So this, by the way, is a source of incredible philosophical debate, right? Absolutely, there's a school of thought that says, for sure, that the essence of Torah is found in Talmud Torah. The application is another piece to it, but there is a value in just the learning for learning's sake. So I'll give you the most extreme example. If someone learns Torah for an hour every single day, but absolutely does not implement anything they learn, is there value in that learning? I'm learning Hilchos Shabbos. No. Reuven is learning Hilchos Shabbos, and he does not keep Shabbos. Is there value in that learning?
Yeah.
So, what does the Bar Tanura say? Is there value in that learning?
No.
The Bar Tanura says there is no value in that learning. Ein ikir kibul schar, ela b'shvil ha-maisa. The Bar Tanura will say the value of Torah is found in its application, is found in the way you act, is found in the way you live. The learning is a means to a heightened lifestyle. The learning is a means to an observance. The learning is a means to dynamic activity. And therefore, the Bar Torah says something amazing. Get ready for this. Hadorish ve'eno mekayim. Therefore what? If someone learns, and what? Eno mekayim. Doesn't uphold it. Noach lo imhaya shosik v'lo haya dorish. What's about to say? If you're going to learn and not do, then what?
Better not to learn.
Anyone find this distressing?
Yeah.
Incredibly distressing. Right? Because aren't we conditioned, just distressing on a number of levels. On the most basic level, we usually assume that something is better than nothing. That's the general approach in Yiddishkeit that we take. Something is always better than nothing. So here HaKadosh Baruch Hu, okay, I'm not observing, I'm not doing, but I'm learning, I'm doing something, right? Again, I'm serving you, and it's true. I'm not putting into practice that which I'm learning. There's no question, there's a disconnect between what I know to be true and the way I live. Okay, but I'm doing something. The Bar Tanura says no. The Bar Tanura Rosh Hashanah says is lo matzasi leguftov mishtika means is connected to the next statement. V'lo amedrash ha'ikar ela hamaisa. So that statement means that the ikar of learning is what? Why does a Jew learn? Why do you learn? To do. Learning is not an ends. And by the way, just as where the Bar Tanura is coming from, if learning is an ends, then what does that make learning into? An educational or intellectual exercise. If that's what Torah is, if there's a concept of learning Torah in a vacuum without any life application, then it's an intellectual exercise like any other intellectual exercise. That's not what Torah is. Torah is a Torah's chayim. Torah teaches us how to live. Torah, and by the way, I want to point out to you, so you'll say to yourself, if that's the case, then what should I be learning? Only practical things. But there is a whole Torah that's out there. Now I want to tell you something very important. Every part of Torah is practical, and that's practical life advice, and that's practical ramifications for day-to-day living. Sometimes the practicality of it is explicit. Sometimes you have to dig for it a little bit. But the practicality is always there. There is not one word of Torah. And by the way, what's the proof to that?
Vayikra,
excellent. Right, the proof to that is there is a large swath of the Chumash. It's even more than a fifth. Remember, Vayakel, Pekudei, Kisis, Trumat, Tetzavi, Kisis, Vayakel, Pekudei. You have 1.5 Chumash from the Torah that have seemingly no practical application. But they do. You just have to skim beneath the surface a little bit. Yes? Oh, so good. So I'm with you on this. I'm with you on the learning camp also. We're going to get to that in Meretz Hashem, our next class. What I want to point out to you is that that's not what the Bar Tanura is saying. Right? What the Bar Tanura is clearly coming of the opinion that, again, the purpose of learning is to enhance the way you live. So if it doesn't enhance the way you live, the Bar Tanura actually says that, it would be better to what?
Not learn out.
Now, how can you make it so that it's better not to learn at all?
Better if you're.
So it could be better that you're a show gig and not amazing. What else could it mean? Better to be genuine than disingenuous. If you're not going to do it, then don't open the safer. If you're not going to mean to be a genuine person, to learn and to know what's correct and not to do it, the Bar Tanura posits is disingenuous. HaKadosh Baruch Hu could deal with imperfections. HaKadosh Baruch Hu could deal with shortcomings. What HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't like is when a person is disingenuous. So you're not going to do it? Fine. There are other ways, by the way, to serve the world. You could be about tzedakah. You could help old ladies cross the street. Right? You could do a variety of different things. But if you're not going to practice that what you're learning, then that is fundamentally disingenuous. And therefore, again, and I can't tell you, like, it's a very dramatic idea. Therefore, says the Bar Tanura, v'habdorish ve'eino mekayim, if you learn and you do not uphold it, noach lo'em hayashosek v'lo hayadori. Should be better not to learn at all. Yes.
So good,
because I want to be clear, this is one stream. You're saying good, and I am with you. I'm not going to say it bothers the Bar Tanura, but it's exceptionally bothersome. It's because what it does is it creates almost like an absolutist type of Judaism. Either you're all in, and if you're all in, then learn. But if you're not all in, then don't learn. So what does that mean? How could anyone claim that they're all in? All of us struggle with different things. And one day I'm all into this and not so into this. And one day I'm all into this. That's the cycle of life. So how did Bartonura's model actually goes ahead and manifests in a practical way, we'll have to see. Right now I'm just exposing you to this philosophy, which I think for many of us is so incredibly foreign. Yes?
Could it be that as long as you're learning,
I love it. It's beautiful, except I don't know how you read it into the words. Because the Bartonura state, again, look at his words. V'hadoresh ve'eino mekayim, noach lo'em haya shosek, v'lo haya doresh. Now, I'll tell you one way you can interpret this, by the way, which could allow you to sleep well tonight, which is that doresh could also mean be referring to someone who what? Who teaches. So it could be that what the Bartonura is referring to over here is the idea of don't teach it, don't preach it if you don't live it. Right? In other words, that maybe that's the idea. Meir Reb Shimon Gamliel is saying, and again, if you take that approach, then Reb Shimon Gamliel is saying this, Kol yom gadalti bein hachamim. All of my days I grew up amongst great teachers. I grew up amongst great teachers. And I've come to find that the greatest teachers are the ones who practice what they teach. I purposely changed that. Practice what they teach, not preach. You should never preach. Right? They practice what they teach. And if you're not going to practice what you teach, then what? Then what? Then don't teach. Then lo matzasi leguftom shich. So that is a possibility. That is a possibility. And maybe that resonates a little bit better. I'm trying to stir the controversy a little bit because we're going to see a major, major philosophical debate about the role of Torah and the role of learning. But again, that is a possibility. Yes?
Could it be that he's saying, if you're learning it and you're not going to implement it in your life, then you're not learning it right?
It could be. It could be. But again, I'm hung up on his word usage, right? Remember again, I'm not making this up, I promise. You could look, his word usage itself is, Noach lo im haya shosek velo haya. Shosek is a strong word. Shosek means what? To be quiet. That's strong wording. It's better to be quiet and not do anything. So you could be right. I just don't know. I wouldn't know how to read that into the words. Yes? Based on what we've seen in his personality.
Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent, excellent. Hold on to that for a little bit. We're going to see, by the way, I want to point out to you, it's not just you guys, everyone jumps on the Bartonura, right? This Bartonura stirs up a lot of controversy. And in fact, one of the things we're going to see is it's totally atypical from Shimon Gamliel. He is a Koach HaMa'achid. He's not looking to push people away. He's saying that Tzdukim are Jews. So what? If somebody wants to sit and learn Torah, but they're not going to observe, we're going to tell them that's meaningless and don't do it, doesn't seem to shtim with who he is. Excellent. Excellent.
The verb of shosek, that doesn't mean you're not, does that mean that you're not learning? Shosek
just means
you're not thinking out
what you're saying. So good. That's what I'm saying. It could also mean that doresh could be referring to the teachers. Right? Doresh could be referring to teachers and not necessarily to the learner. And he could be saying to the teacher, if you're not going to practice what you teach, don't teach. Don't teach. So absolutely, that could resonate with that approach as well. Yes? So, I don't know. I didn't find anyone, but you know, there's a lot of Torah out there. So, I didn't find anyone. I'm sure that there are people who I mean, it's the Bartonura. He hasn't actually need anyone to agree with him, but I would be surprised if there weren't others that are part of this same school of thought. We'll see a lot more on the other side of the disagreement. Yes?
When people don't do things, if they're learning it, they're not learning it. And if you're learning it, you want to do it. Still
you want it. So that is a beautiful, beautiful thought. But not always true. There are a lot of times that people learn stuff because they have intellectual curiosity, but they have absolutely no intention of doing anything that they learn. It's my sin b'chol. you're coming from a purist perspective, which is beautiful. You're saying, if the neshama is learning, then of course it wants to do. We'll see what happens later on. And you might be true, like on a neshama level. Whenever the neshama is learning, there's always the desire. But there's no question, there are absolutely people who sit down to learn Torah that have absolutely no intention. Some of them, it could be even be, you give me an apikores. Even a person doesn't believe anything. There's, Torah is incredible. Gemara is incredible.
They're
halacha is...
They
could, also, they could be learning it to bolster their own group. I'm sorry?
So,
okay, so good. We're going to have to define who the audience is. Who are we talking about over here? Maybe this is tied into the Tzedukin discussion. Good. Hold on to that. We're going to see.
Question. As you're learning, even subconsciously, you're going to get something out of it.
So you're saying, again, on the neshama level, even if a person says, hinini mukhana muzuman, to not observe anything, I'm not going to do anything, but you're saying there's a panemius that happens that when a person learns Torah, beautiful. Good. You're all, by the way, you're all saying great. And you're going to be very happy on Monday, Amir Hashem, when we focus on the other school of thought. So we'll stop over here for today. But again, I'm leaving you a little bit with this Bar Tanura. But just understand, this Bar Tanura is troubling, but it can be understood multiple ways. I think the Pashat Pshat to the Bar Tanura is, he's telling us, if you're not going to practice, don't learn. If you're not going to do it, if you're not going to practice, don't learn, because it would be better than if you just be silent. Other possibility back to Nur is that no. Person should always learn. He's focusing on who? He's focusing on who? The teachers. And he's telling the teacher, if you want to make an impression on people, the best way to make an impression is not by your oratory abilities or by your sense of humor or by teaching methodologies. It's by you being a genuine person. If you are not going to go ahead and be genuine, then at the end of the day, better to be silent. All right, let's stop over here for today. We'll pick up, what we'll do is next week we'll do Monday this Mishnah, and then Amir Tashem Wednesday, maybe we'll begin a little bit on Purim.